Hello, Charlie with Mountain Trails.
Good morning, Carolyn. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks.
Hey, so things are looking pretty nice out there. We did get quite the rain last night, so might take a little bit this morning to have things dry out. But I'm sure that by afternoon, things should be looking pretty good. A couple of things probably to talk about. As you well know, we're starting to be in summer business world again, and things are getting a little more hectic than that wonderful slow season we had this year, thanks to the rain, I guess. So a little reminder, we have lots of visitors out there. Everybody's here to have fun. Let's just remember to kind of slow down, smile, be safe about it out there, whether you're biking, hiking, running, walking your dog, doesn't really matter. Everyone's here to have a good time. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Carolina, is today going to be the first day of Deer Valley opening for the summer?
Oh, yeah, for mountain biking. Is today the first day?
Yeah, for mountain biking
okay.
And so forth. It'll be up and going. Also, we do want to announce a trail we did last year, a directional trail that comes down from the Crescent Lift area right by Tommy's Two Step, is officially going to be considered open as of today. And it is rideable, and certainly recommend it. It's a great way down, and currently Mojave is still a little sticky and muddy, and just because of the size of the turns and the exposure. So this is a great way to get down. That run is trail will be called Silver Queen. So just coming down from that area on the ski area.
So where does it take?
That.
Where do you come out off of the Silver Queen, the new trail?
You come out on Mid Mountain, probably half a mile, maybe half a mile or a little more north of the Angle Station.
Okay, and is Tommy Two Step turning into a one way at some point, or?
We're still waiting to hear that. We'd love to make that announcement right this moment, but at the moment we can't. But I think the ski area has been in very cooperative on suggestions like that from us, so I think we might see that come along here in the next little bit. What else is going on? I think Crescent Lift opens today as well over at Park City. And then the last thing is our 2019 trail map, Carolyn, will be coming out. We're a little behind the eight ball, but it will be this next week. So probably look for it at the end of the week. It's just taking a little bit of time to get it out. And we apologize. We're a little behind. That's our fault, Mountain Trail's fault. But the 2018 trail maps that are in the stores, and if you're actually in the stores handing them out to visitors, those maps are 99.999% accurate. So there's really no reason not to actually still just buy one of those maps.
Sure.
So, other than that, I think did I cover everything?
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to mention that the new Treasure Hill Trail that was the recipient of all that hard work from volunteers on Trail Day, I rode that the other day, and it was fantastic. And what a great alternative to that Lower Sweeney.
I think Rick is listening in right now, so you can pass that off to Rick. He is the designer and so forth, and we have a great trail crew out there, and Rick heads up that trail crew. So kudos to Rick and the crew.
Yeah,
forgot to mention that, but another great way to get up on the mountain. And also if you're in Old Town, that's a great way to get started.
Yeah.
So anyways, I think I've covered it. Get out there, have fun. Looks like it's going to be a great weekend.
Thank you. That's Charlie Sturgis with the Mountain Trails Foundation. Oh, I have our first guest, Summit County Emergency Manager Chris Crowley, in with us to talk about just preparation for the summer months and maybe give us a little bit of an update on the runoff and wildland fire issues and that kind of thing. Thanks for coming by. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I was looking at this website called WaterWatchUSGS.com mm-hmm. and just kind of clicking on some of the area rivers like the Weber and the Upper Provo. And it looks like we're between 80 and 85% basically flow as of yesterday. What are the concerns that you have with the flooding and the runoff this season? I mean, are there certain areas that you're especially watching and worried about?
Yeah, we keep a close watch on that website in particular. Is a fantastic resource. It's got Great information about and real-time flow information. It also has a predictive component, which allows us to, you know, forecast a few days ahead and make preparations if necessary. Right now, our predictions for the Provo show a little bit of runoff moving into the not quite into the flood stage, but into that stage where we want to keep a close watch on it so we know what's going on and we're prepared.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about the areas where people maybe aren't so aware of the danger. I mean, we know a river, if it's moving fast and it's cold, that you want to keep your kids and your pets safely, you know, away from that. But talk about some of the other things we were just discussing, culverts and canals and irrigation ditches and that type of thing.
Yeah, I think those areas that we would typically walk our dogs or let our kids, you know, jump across the culvert or something, these are all dangerous areas right now because the water is running fast, it's running swift, and it's very cold. There's also the chance of, you know, being swept downriver into some snags or strainers, such as, you know, debris or trees that have fallen into the river, or into those culverts and drainages. Again, it's dangerous and something that you need to monitor very, very closely with your dogs and kids.
Yeah, there last week we had reported on a canal that's over by the Swanner Nature Preserve, mm-hmm. adjacent to that on Cutter Lane, and how that water, it's a 5-foot deep canal. The water was up to 4 feet at that point. Are you seeing still that kind of runoff going on in some of these areas?
A lot of that is subsided, mainly because it really happens when we have the melt coupled with a lot of rain, and Cutter in particular seemed to be a rain event a few days before, and then everything, the ground becoming saturated. Again, we're melting at a relatively normal rate, but it's a lot of water. There's no two ways about it. We have a high snowpack this year, so a lot of water will be melting off.
Yeah. So do you watch sort of on a day in and day out how much snowpack is still up there, or is that left to the hydrologists, or how does that work between the jurisdictions?
Yeah, we speak directly with the National Weather Service and with their hydrologist. That predictive map is really based on calculations and predictions, including all of those variables. I think that to get into weather science, it's quite complicated, but it is so accurate, and that I can't thank those guys enough for that valuable information.
Okay, and a lot of us are thinking, oh, we've had such a wet year, wet spring, you know, the soil's moist, we don't need to worry about wildland fires. That is wrong.
That is absolutely wrong, and wildland fire should always be considered one of the biggest dangers in Summit County, and something that everybody should be very much aware of, and understand that you can start a wildland fire from the simplest of mistakes. For instance, the Brian Head fire was a guy burning off his weeds. That was a terrible fire.
Bad choice.
Absolutely.
We don't burn weeds here, do we?
I definitely would advise against it.
Sure. What other things should people pay attention to? I mean, this one fire that had happened in Tollgate last year, mm-hmm. Was just a spark that came off of a trailer chain that hit a rock. I mean, these are really random instances.
Absolutely. And you know, fires can start in many different places for many different reasons. That particular one was a spark that, you know, lit the cheatgrass on fire. The cheatgrass then lights the next fuel on fire, and it just continues to build from there. And so those are things that homeowners or renters or just anybody walking along a path should be aware of, that the most random thing or mistake can, in fact, cause a fire, and they should always be aware of that.
So what is the regulation on open fires here in Summit County?
Well, if you're going to be burning anything, you need to make sure that you have a permit to burn, and you can get that through the fire warden. Be aware of red flag days when we don't allow any burning. Wind conditions, of course, dictate most of those. If we have winds that are even slightly high, it's not a good day to burn.
And do a lot of the agricultural areas need to burn frequently through the fire season, or is that a thing that typically they would wait and do when it gets colder and wetter? How does that usually work?
Well, I would expect that most of the agricultural burning has already happened. The farmers are on top, and ranchers are on top of that, and they work directly with the fire warden for all of those permits. So it's not unheard of that somebody would need to do some sort of slash pile burning later in the season, but we would definitely advise earlier or later, you know, once it gets a little bit more moisture.
Okay, and what about campers? What I mean, does each campsite have a separate regulation? Are there different rules and guidelines?
Yeah, definitely different rules and guidelines. And of course, I think common sense is one of those important factors. There might be a camp ring, but if you notice that there is just flammable materials all over the place, you need to take extra special precautions, which includes making sure that your fire is completely extinguished, which means pouring a ton of water on it so that all embers are completely extinguished.
Right, because wind can just kick in and you've got sparks and it just
exactly.
takes that much. So what about this discussion this year, so much discussion on defensible space?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what that is and who needs to ensure that that's what they have around their property or home.
Yeah, everybody needs to ensure that they have defensible space around their property. And that doesn't mean cutting down every single tree and bush. It's really creating space around your home that will allow firefighters to access your home so that they can do their job, and for you to just eliminate some of those major threats that might be close to your home, such as dead trees, especially if they're evergreens that are close to your home, or anything that, again, can create that ladder effect where if something is burning, it can actually get to your home, and if your home has flammable materials around it, which would include your deck, but you know, storing fuel and wood and propane underneath your deck or in a space that could in fact be touched by a flame or an ember, those are dangerous situations, and making sure that the soffit vents in your house have the proper screening so that embers don't have access to get into your home.
Yeah, and I guess you also would want to clear away any growth that is sort of coming up under your soffits or that type of thing.
Yeah, anything that would allow an ember or a flame to enter your home, you definitely want to make sure that you take precautions.
Okay. And does that apply to people who even live like in our area neighborhoods like Prospector and Park Meadows and Thames Canyon, that type of thing?
Absolutely. Anywhere where there's a home or a tree, we're always in danger of fires.
Okay, great. Chris, do you want to add anything else to... Oh, let me ask about this because 4th of July is coming. Mm-hmm. What is the regulation on firecrackers and backyard ballistics?
Well, I think at this point we are following the state laws, and we've had years where Park City or Summit County has adopted additional regulations. I don't know what the status is at this point of those additional regulations, but no matter what, fireworks are fire and they're extremely dangerous, so be careful if you do choose to use them.
Okay, and we'll keep people posted on what kind of regulations come down as we get closer.
Yeah.
So, okay, anything else you'd like to add, Chris?
just want everybody to be safe and again, make the efforts to prepare. And everybody should be prepared not only to be safe around their home, but also understand how they would leave their home in the event of a major emergency.
Okay. Okay, that's Summit County Emergency Manager Chris Crowley. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
My next guest is Jane Gendron. She has been on the job as the Park City Magazine editor for about a year now, and it is out as of yesterday and being distributed.
It is being distributed by our hardworking Sharon Payne. She is all over town today and tomorrow, and they should be everywhere in the coming days. So
it's the usual format, lots of local writers, local features, that type of thing.
Correct.
And yes. On the cover, you've got a big, beautiful picture of the biking guide.
Yes,
as
yep,
the highlight.
Eric Schramm captured a gorgeous Lost Prospector image of a mountain biker. And yeah, it's just gorgeous. So,
yeah. And you also, I was looking through it a little earlier this morning, you've got a really nice spread on road rides as well as mountain bike rides for those who like to do
correct.
Both.
And I am not a road cyclist, so I had to enlist Todd Henneman from Storm Cycles as my interviewee for that. And he gave me some really great rides to share with everyone. So,
yeah, fantastic. And then I also noticed that there is a feature on Utah's craft brews, which
yes,
is really
yes,
great.
Darby Doyle had the challenging job of picking beer for this issue. She's a wonderful food writer, and so she picked, I believe it was 17 must-sip beers, and then she, you know, we went into history and hops happenings and, you know, just all things beer, which is mm-hmm. a really fun piece, yes.
Yes, and being Friday, there are probably going to be a few people who might want to have a look at that suggestion
of
list
course,
and
yes.
get out and,
seems like
and try
time.
A few to sip perhaps this evening.
Correct.
So, all right, and then Larry Warren, our prior general manager for KPCW, has written a story highlighting the new president and COO of Deer Valley.
Yes.
Yeah, Todd Shallon.
Yeah, he did a Q&A with Todd, and we typically do a Q&A every issue. And since Todd's the new guy after Bob Wheaton's long, long run at Deer Valley, we thought it was a good idea to give him a spotlight, mm-hmm. see what he's doing at the resort. So, yeah, Larry did a great job.
Well, great. And one of the things that I have so enjoyed in this past year is the public art, and you've got a feature piece on that as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody has not been into China Bridge to have a look at the murals that were painted there last summer, I think it was.
I
last
believe
summer.
So, yes.
So it's been almost a year maybe that it's been there. Just a spectacular, fantastic way to brighten up a parking garage.
Yeah, well, that piece was a way for us to introduce the new director of Park City Summit County Arts Council as well, Jocelyn. And she's a spitfire, really getting a lot of energy going in the arts community, particularly with public art. Vanessa Connaby did that piece as well as a couple others. And the underpasses everywhere. It's really brightening up our public mm-hmm. spaces. So they're doing a fabulous job.
Yeah. I think the essence of this is just don't miss the Park City Magazine this year, because there's a lot of really fun stuff. Oh, and I forgot to mention also the wraps that are on our utility boxes in town. Some of those are just amazing.
There's art everywhere.
They're everywhere. It's art everywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing just to mention about this issue is my art director, who's out of Portland, she does a fabulous job. She said to me, you know what? I really liked the diversity in this issue. And I said, wow, you know, it wasn't engineered diversity, which I thought was really great. It just kind of naturally happened. The stories we came up with, the people that we ended up profiling, a nice mix. And so I thought that was a really interesting and poignant comment about the magazine this time around. Not that it hasn't been diverse in the past, but she kind of highlighted that for me, and I thought, wow, yeah, we got some really diverse people here in Park City, and it's nice to see that shine through in the magazine.
Yeah, and so Jane, you've been doing this for about a year,
correct?
And that means that you've brought one winter issue to
correct.
The streets, and then this is I guess your first summer issue.
Correct.
What have been the biggest challenges for you transitioning? Where did you come from before?
And well, I have actually always contributed to Park City Magazine for 20 years as a freelancer. So I worked with Kristen Case and Melissa Fields. So I'm very familiar with the magazine. and I came from freelancing, and prior to that from the Park City Institute. And prior to that, from the Park Record. the challenges, I think some of the challenges are really fitting all of the stories into the magazine, trying to keep it evergreen, service-oriented, visitor-friendly, so it gives them the basics of Park City, but still fresh and new for the local reader. So you've got two different audiences here that you're trying to reach, give them fresh content, interesting content, new content, but also the evergreen, gosh, I've never been to Park City before. What's this town about? So it's that balance of evergreen and and local.
So talk a little bit about the distribution. How many pieces have you published, and where do they go?
That's a great question for Sharon. Okay. I don't know exactly how many pieces we publish. They are in the hotel rooms, the properties, all over the place. So if you're staying somewhere, you'll typically find one in your hotel room. We have them at Dolly's, at coffee shops, at visitor centers, at the libraries, really at the grocery stores, at Whole Foods. You'll find them all over the place. And Sharon and her crew really get those things out there and moving. And then they're across the country, they show up in like airport lounges, and people, we obviously have subscribers and mailing lists that they go to as well. So,
and I guess that's what you want. You want people to take them home and
exactly
enjoy
them.
Yeah,
we love it when people take them home and the property manager calls and says, "Can you send us more? We need more." So yeah.
Okay. So you basically keep printing through the season until winter is ready to go, and then you move into the next edition.
Into winter, yeah, and then we have the whole digital component to the magazine, which is ongoing and. It's a fresh content every week, but different in nature as digital is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jane, anything else you want to say about the edition coming out?
I just really wanted to thank the writers that and the photographers that really pour their hearts and souls into the work they do. It's a lot of work, and I think they put together great pieces for me and great stuff for me to work with. And then the small but mighty team at the office does really hard work. And Janet and Greg and Sharon, there's just a little crew of us. And it's a hardworking little crew that puts out a really cool piece. So,
yeah. And this is free, basically.
It is there. You can purchase it at the grocery stores, or you can pick it up
at these other places.
At the other locations, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so. Great. Thank you very much. That's Jane Gendron. She is the Park City Magazine editor, and appreciate you coming by.
Thanks so much.
Local News Hour, it's 8:40. My next guest is Nancy Haga. She's the founder of the Solstice Flute Festival, and that is scheduled for Friday, June 21st on Solstice. And I believe that will be at the Homestead in Midway on the Lawn. Welcome, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Welcome. This is Nancy Haga.
Hi, Nancy. So tell us a little bit about the program you're offering there. I guess it starts Friday, June 21st, and will also be held on the 22nd Saturday at the Homestead?
Yes, that's right. This is a two-day Solstice Native Flute Festival that follows a four-day Native Flute School that we have had for the last, this will be our seventh year. And the school, my goodness, was sold out in 3 months, and we wanted to make sure that these award-winning recording artists that we bring in as our teachers could be enjoyed by the community. So we created a festival around that and made that available to the community. It is a free two-day festival at the homestead out on the West Lawn, complete with live music throughout the day, artisans, free concerts in the evenings featuring our recording artists both on Friday and on Saturday. And there are a number of workshops, some of which are free, some of which are fee-based.
So tell me, how many people attend the flute school, the four-day flute school?
The flute school, we will have about 60 people from all over the country and even overseas that come in for that. It's just an incredible opportunity to either learn how to play this wonderful healing instrument, both to learn it and also to advance your skills. The beauty of this instrument, it's just so ethereal, hypnotic, and there's no music to read. This is truly music from your soul that you play through this instrument that has, it's one of the oldest instruments, along with the drum, thousands of years old is when they first found these instruments.
So are you...
yeah, it's open for people of all ages.
Oh, that's amazing. So if you have never played any kind of an instrument at all, you could sign up and learn how to play at your school.
Well, not for the school right now. You'll have to be early on the list for the next year's school. This one is sold out.
Sure.
However, we do have two free classes during the festival where we will teach you to play the instrument. And as long as you can breathe and wiggle your fingers, you can learn to play. And we'll have instruments there for people to borrow if they don't have any of their own. Of course, there will be flute makers there that will be happy to have you try out their flutes and buy anything that touches you. But the free flute class is taught by Shelley Morningsong, and once again, she's an award-winning recording artist, one of our teachers. It'll be held from noon to 1 o'clock on both Friday and Saturday. So if anybody wants to come, regardless of age, please come and learn how to play. There'll be a lot of people who would love to share it with you.
So in looking at your schedule, you've got an Anasazi flute class, you have a beginner flute class, and then you have an open mic on stage.
Yes.
Wrap-up, I guess that's for the concert on Saturday? Or is that Friday,
the
concert?
Open mic is probably both days. I'm looking at the schedule as well. I'm not sure when the open mic is, but the open mic will be pretty much throughout each day. We've got back-to-back performers who will be appearing on the festival stage, which is kind of an open mic. There are about 15 musicians, including our teachers, who will be performing on the festival stage throughout the day. And when there are breaks between them, there will be open mic time for people who want to come up and play. If they're not on the list, please come up and share the music.
Okay, sounds great. And anything else you want to say about the event?
Oh, my goodness. It's just our gift to the community. And certainly we hope that people come and make this what we hope to be a signature event. It'll be running all day Friday, all day Saturday, free concerts on Friday night. The Friday night one starts at 6:30. The Saturday night one starts at 7, and if people would like more information, please go to our website, which is www.solsticeflute.org. We are an all-volunteer, nonprofit, 501c3 organization, and we would love your support. Come and enjoy this incredible music.
Well, thank you, Nancy Haga, founder of the Solstice Flute Festival, beginning today, I guess, and running through tomorrow.
No, it begins next week.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Yeah, the school begins Monday, but the festival that's open to everyone begins next Friday and next Saturday, the 21st and 22nd.
Let's not hurry June along.
Get yourself out there quick. You can wait for us.
Yes, thank you so much, Nancy.
You're so welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Bye now. Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I have my next guest, Sandra Morrison. She's the executive director of the Park City Museum, and she is here in the studio to talk with us about the traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian called Patios, Pools, and the Invention of the American Backyard, which sounds fantastic. And then also upcoming this weekend is the Historic Home Tour. Thanks for coming by.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell us about, let's start with the Smithsonian exhibit. So what have we brought in exhibits from the Smithsonian in the past?
We have brought a few in. You know, the Smithsonian realized a number of years ago that unless people were going to make it to Washington, D.C., you know, there were a lot of people in the country that were never going to see their collections. And, you know, Washington, D.C. obviously is a long way away from Utah. So they started this traveling exhibition program. And, you know, and of course, they do a fabulous job. They hold the nation's collection. And this one is about patios, pools, and the invention of the American backyard. It's an interesting exploration into, you know, the invention of the backyard, which you would never think had to be invented, but it really happened, you know, post-World War II with, you know, track housing and people moving to the suburbs, and also with the, you know, 5-day, 8-hour work week, people had weekends available. And so, you know, they started designing, you know, backyards. People had larger properties, you know, could install pools and just, you know, how they brought the living space to the outdoors. And you know, the use of the house moved from everyone sitting on the front porch watching, you know, their neighborhood go by to being more secluded in the backyard and, you know, having more family time in the backyard. Yeah.
Yeah. So what will the exhibit entail? Is it actual samples of what backyards may have looked like 50 years ago?
Yeah. So it's a delightful mixture of vintage photographs, obviously, you know, a lot of post-World War II. So 40s, 50s, 60s, and then historic drawings, and then period advertisements as well. You know, so you buy a pool or here's the latest barbecue.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, pave your backyard because it's more useful. Yeah.
Sure. And it also strikes me that the whole nursery industry of flowers and pots and just that use of decorative natural growing products it's just amazing. You go to a Smith's, you go to our Park City Nursery here, you just the amount that is in the garden center.
Right. And, you know, the exhibit's broken up into different components, and there's even a section, you know, talking about the uses of fertilizers and chemicals, and, Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring is featured in there, you know, talking about the use of DDT. And, yeah, so it gets into a lot of different aspects that came out of this development.
Yeah.
You know, of a private outdoor living space.
Yeah. And how about yard art?
Yeah.
All the backyard kitsch that we see in stores and in our homes.
Yeah. Pink flamingos and all.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a particular penchant for those myself. So.
And of course, it's a great way. This exhibit is a great way for us to celebrate our historic home tour, because most of the homes that we feature on the home tour, or all of them this year, are built in that earlier time period. In fact, we have a number of them that were built even in the 1870s, which is some of Park City's earliest homes. But I mean, just from looking at them, you can see that the outdoor living space as such in these homes was the front porch. It was all about the focus of what's happening out on the street. And of course, back in the 1870s and the 1880s, it wasn't, you know, motor vehicles driving past with exhaust fumes. It was people out there walking and mm-hmm. the occasional horse. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And the interaction so much different with our neighbors. I heard recently about a statistic outlining how few people really know who their neighbors are. You know, not even their names.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, people that live on the same street.
And of course, that's an interesting discussion in Park City, and especially in the historic district where, you know, almost 80% of the homes are owned by second homeowners. So yeah. You'll be lucky if you actually even see your neighbors because they don't live here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, let's move on to the home tour. What are the details around
that? So the home tour is tomorrow. From 10 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. We have 10 historic homes along with the Washington School Inn and the Crescent Tramway, so 12 historic places to visit. And they're all located on a loop, the 5 and 600 blocks of Park Avenue and Woodside. The tour headquarters is at the Town Lift Bridge, thanks to the Sweeney family for allowing us to set up there again this year. And it's a self-guided tour, but we have volunteer docents in each of the homes. And, you know, we've done a lot of research on the history and the families that built the homes and lived in the homes over the years. And so they'll be giving you, you know, quite the discussion about the history of the homes. And most people, you know, spend about 2 hours. So come anytime, get your tickets, and we have booties to wear so that you don't track all the dirt into all these wonderful homes that people are, you know, very proud of. And everybody's been working very hard, actually, in the last couple of months, you know, because they're being featured on the home tour.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So we're very proud of our homeowners, and we thank them for opening their homes up for the day.
So how does it work? Somebody owns an historic property, and do they apply to be on the tour?
Usually,
or do you reach out to them.
Okay. You know, we choose a different area every year. We like to get homes that are close together, so it can be a pure walking tour. We don't, you know, need people driving, and so we, feature a couple of block section, you know, in Old Town. And we move around town sort of in a counterclockwise direction, actually. And then, you know, what's happened over the last few years is someone's come on the tour and said, oh, my house is at, you know, and give us the address. And we're like, oh, well, we'd love to do that area next year.
Yeah. Okay.
And that gives them a real flavor for, you know, how the tour works
and how
what's going to happen.
How old does a home need to be an historic home?
We've even had some of the skiing era A-frames on the tour this year because, you know, that area of Park Avenue especially was where all the merchants lived in Park City. So, as I said, they're older. So some of them from the 1870s, 1880s. And then we have three houses that were destroyed in the Great Fire of 1898. So those three were built about 1900. And then we even have one that was a remodel that happened in about 1910. So, yeah, interesting that a house built in the 1870s gets remodeled.
Yeah,
40 years later. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all the same history that we see today, right?
Sure.
It's happening
sure.
out in Park Meadows. People don't like those 1970s, 100 years later. Yep, and here we are.
Well, I was sort of leaning there.
Remodeling
I have one of those 1970s homes.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, we haven't had a historic home tour in Park Meadows yet, but
it's
stay
on the
tuned.
Horizon,
yes,
possibly.
Yes, I think so.
We just have to get a little older.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, the city sort of has that, you know, 50-year benchmark as kind of the nationwide standard for, you know, historic homes. But, you know, some things become historic even sooner than 50 years of age.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there's a lot of talk about mid-century modern homes, and we have a few of those. Of course, Park City's history in the 40s and the 50s, we really weren't building any houses at all because there was no bank on earth that was going to give you a mortgage to build a house. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So some really interesting homes were built because at that point, the people that lived here had lived in these older homes their entire lives. So a lot of stories of couples getting married and, you know, the groom, the one thing he wanted to give his bride was a new house because that was so far beyond their reach that would be, you know, the best thing he could provide. And, you know, stories of people going up in the Uintas and actually cutting down trees and you know, lumbering it themselves, masons, you know, building, you know, homes from bricks or concrete block, and doing the work all themselves because there was no way they could get a loan from a bank.
And they're really, if you think about it, that era, the 50s, 40s, 50s,
yeah.
There's
a few, yeah, but not very many. And like I said, they're all made by the people that built them. I mean, you know, when you say handmade, that's as handmade as you can get
when
you go and cut your own lumber.
Well, and also just the interiors and decorating them and how you would sort of bring back the image of that lifestyle in the 40s and 50s. I don't know if people do that anymore with their homes. I mean, they're either doing really historic and kind of rough mountain lifestyle looks on the interior, or really modern,
yes,
you know, kind of slick and clean and you know, that kind of thing. So it would be a really interesting exploration.
Yeah, and, you know, yeah. The historic home tour is interesting in that regard as well, because, of course, you have to look at these homes as when they were built, there was no such thing as, you know, indoor plumbing or central heating and, you know, possibly even no electricity for those ones built in the 1870s. And, you know, how did the miners live back then? And then, you know, to what degree have these owners tried to make these very small houses livable today with modern conveniences? Yeah. So, you know, it's not like a home tour, you know, where you're going out into the suburbs to see the latest and greatest construction and three-car garages and modern appliances. This is, you know, an exploration into how you can adaptively reuse, mm-hmm. you know, an historic home and celebrate its history. And, of course, that takes a special person and special dedication.
Yeah. Well, so much to learn and so much to see this weekend with the Park City Historic Home Tour and a visit maybe to the museum.
Yeah, so the tickets for the home tour are available at the museum on our website at parkcityhistory.org. And then, of course, you can buy them on the day of the tour. As I said, the tour headquarters is at the Townlift Plaza. And anytime between 10. Well, don't come at 3 o'clock. You're not going to get to see much. So definitely come by 2.
Give yourself some time. And how much are the tickets?
And so the tickets are $20.
Okay.
And then we do offer a discount for members of the Park City Museum. Okay. And then our Smithsonian exhibition will open on Saturday as well. And it'll be on exhibit actually through to November. So you've got some time to come and see that one. Yeah.
Thank you.
And so that one was created in partnership with the Smithsonian Gardens Archive.
Okay. Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much. That's Sandra Morrison, Executive Director of the Park City Museum. I appreciate you coming by.